This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. While many of us will spend Independence Day at cookouts and fireworks, our guests today are anticipating another celestial event. On July 4th, NASA's Juno spacecraft fires up its engines to enter the Jovian atmosphere in a mission that will bring our closest view ever of the planet Jupiter. We're talking with our sky guys today in The Exchange, and they're joining astronomers worldwide who are incredibly excited about Juno. Still, it's a mission full of possible peril for the probe, as described here in a promotional video from NASA.
We're going to go in close, get the data, and get out. And the first time we go in, that's the most dangerous. We call it Jupiter Orbit Insertion. J-O-I.
Today in The Exchange, we travel to Jupiter and beyond with our sky guys. We'll talk about Juno and other headlines, including a forthcoming movie that raises a lot more questions about humans' ability to survive in space. Let's hear from you. Your questions and comments for the Sky Guys are welcome. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests are Mal Cameron, former astronomy and space educator at the McAuliffe-Shepard Discovery Center for a long time, more than two decades. Mal was also coordinator of its NASA Educator Resource Center. And Mal, it's always good to see you. Thank you for being here.
It's great to be here, Laura. Thanks.
Also with us, John Gianforte, co-founder of the Astronomical Society of Northern New England and an astronomy instructor for Granite State College and UNH. And John, welcome back. Good to see you, too.
Great to see you, Laura, too. Great to be here.
Well, gentlemen, with that dramatic sound that we just heard from NASA about Juno, we really should start with that. And Mal, you were at the launch of Juno in August 2011 at the Kennedy Space Center. Why is this mission, in your opinion, Mal, such a big deal?
Well, one of the things they're going to do is try to find out the magnetic field around Jupiter that we've known for years is very massive, very dangerous. They want to find out more about it. But in flying this mission, they're going to find out the inner structure, hopefully, of Jupiter as well. There's thought that there might be a solid core of some kind. And by the instrumentation on the spacecraft, they'll be able to send from a closer distance. They're going to fly as close as 3,100 miles above the surface in a big, huge rubber band-shaped orbit, a huge elliptical orbit, and only one far end of it is. The tricky part, well, the unusual part about it is that this is the first mission out that far that's using solar panels and not radiation-type system to run it. The previous one that went out there was Galileo, which had the plutonium-type power source. So they have these massive solar panels that are 50% more efficient than the solar panels here on Earth and are designed to be less susceptible to the radiation that they'll run into around Jupiter. To get an idea of how big that radiation field is, if you go out in the night sky, you can see Jupiter right after the sun sets. It's a bright dot in the sky, and you'll certainly know that it's there if you look to the western sky. And it looks like a very bright dot that doesn't twinkle. That's the hint that you're looking at a planet. But if you could imagine the radiation zone around that, that radiation zone would appear to be as large as the full moon. So it's very massive, and it has not. It's very dangerous to go within that boundary. So this is what they're trying to do with this Juno mission.
So it's important, Mal, because it's the closest look ever that we'll have at this giant planet, but also full of peril, it sounds like. Radiation, also Jupiter's gravity is famous. You know, you fly something too close, it gets sucked in and smashes, basically.
Well, we hear that J-O-I come up. It is a fingers-crossed type thing because they've got all kinds of radiation shielding in the instruments and stuff, and they want to make sure that this is going to work. So that first sweep around the planet is the most important one.
Well, and it is a powerful planet. And yeah, fingers crossed, you definitely get that sense from NASA, Mal.
Right.
Here's an unidentified NASA scientist in an explainer video on this Juno mission. Here he is talking about the power of Jupiter, given just how huge it is.
It's unforgiving. It's relentless. It's spinning around so fast, its gravity is like a giant slingshot, slinging rocks, dust, electrons, whole comets. Anything that gets close to it becomes its weapon.
So let's just clarify here, no people on this probe, by the way. But John Gene Forty, what jumps out at you from this Juno mission? I know astronomers are super excited about it.
Well, aside from the Hollywood hype that NASA's trying to shine on Juno, and justifiably so, it's a really groundbreaking mission because Jupiter is thought to be the first planet in our solar system to have formed. It's the biggest in size, the most massive. It has the most stuff in it. In fact, Jupiter is so massive that it has more mass, more stuff inside of it than all the rest of the planets in the solar system combined.
Wow.
So its magnetic field, its magnetosphere, extends some 600 million miles into space beyond Jupiter, almost to the orbit of Saturn. So this is a huge structure, many times bigger than the biggest object in the solar system, which is the sun. And as Mal said, Jupiter has this very, very powerful magnetic field, which can move and make charged particles move at very high speeds, which means they have lots of energy, which is really bad for people. Of course, there's no people on this mission, but it's bad for spacecraft. So this radiation and high energy charged particles, two different things, but are both hazardous at Jupiter, are really very, very bad for spacecraft. So the electronics inside of Juno are shielded by titanium, and they experience 800 times less radiation than the rest of the spacecraft does. So it's a really hazardous environment. And sure, Jupiter has a very powerful gravity. The interesting thing is, this thing is flying 3,000 miles above the cloud tops of Jupiter. That's really close. You better darn well know where your spacecraft is, because 3,000 miles over 400 million to Jupiter isn't very much margin for error.
So in an ideal world, John, this thing does not get sucked up by Jupiter's gravity or destroyed by radiation. It flies 3,000 miles above. It takes some beautiful pictures and it sends them back to scientists on Earth.
Right. The plan is that it's going to make 33 orbits of Jupiter. And in most of the time when a spacecraft encounters a planet, it usually settles into an orbit above the equator or the lower latitudes. Juno is going to be in a polar orbit. So it's going to orbit the poles. And the reason for this orbit and the low orbit, just 3,000 miles above the clouds, is because that's where the radiation is less.
And so it transmits pictures back. It itself does not come back.
It itself does not come back.
There's no crash landing in the Pacific Ocean.
No.
This.
But at the end of the mission, in order to protect some of the moons of Jupiter that we now know could be habitable, they're going to crash the Juno mission into Jupiter's atmosphere so it burns up like a meteor would burn up in Earth's atmosphere.
That's really interesting. So
they've done that with Galileo, too, in 2003, just so that it wouldn't crash land inadvertently in the future on Europa or Ganymede or Callisto.
So if there were life on one of these Jupiter-Jovian moons, I should put it that way,
Yep. You
don't want to crash land this thing. It might contain bacteria or
exactly.
Introduce
you might have
some
stowaway organisms that weren't killed and in space, even in this deadly radiation. You know, bacteria and small microorganisms are pretty hardy. So in order to protect contaminating one of these potentially hazardous worlds inadvertently, they're gonna destroy the spacecraft when its mission is done.
It's big, Mal, too, right? I've read the
right.
size of a basketball court. This
yeah,
isn't a cute little
about
rover.
Right.
I mean, this is a big thing.
If you took each solar panel, there were three solar panels making, you know, a triangulation off of the basic bus that holds the instruments on it. And if you took the diameter of that whole thing, it's about 66 feet across. Now, the trick is, you've got to have those solar panels always aiming at the sun in order to get all the power. So this is going to be rotating like a very slow windmill. When it actually is in orbit around Jupiter itself, it's going to be rotating at roughly 2 rotations a minute. And as it does, that allows the bus part with all the instruments on it to make 2 rotations as well and map one sweep across from north to south in Jupiter. Now, as John was mentioning, you have to worry about that radiation around it. And one way that I think of it is that if you look at the northern and southern lights that happen, the aurora on Earth, and you look at a map from space on how they react and their place. If you go to like spaceweather.com, you'll find out all about the aurora and how they're formed. And you notice there's this hole at roughly the North Pole and the South Pole that doesn't match our poles exactly because it's magnetic north and south. And that hole is also available because of there's huge auroras on Jupiter. So what they're essentially trying to do is to fly into that hole at the North Pole and out of the hole at the South Pole to minimize the amount of danger they have from all that radiation. Now, to give you an example, one that I read, which I thought was rather interesting to picture this, if you picture Jupiter as roughly the size of a basketball, then this spacecraft is going to be traveling around maybe 3/10 of an inch above that basketball. That's how close it will get to Jupiter. So that's pretty close.
I want to let everybody know that Mal Cameron brought in a beautiful model that he made of this Juno spacecraft and that we have put a picture up on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. We're going to tweet it out as well. It's you did a great job, Mal.
Thanks.
I have to say. So if you're listening,
just
you're wondering
a little hobby of mine.
Well, if you're wondering what the heck does this thing look like, you know, Mal did a terrific model, and we've got a picture up there. So one last question for you, John. As you described, best case scenario, it flies really close, it takes great pictures, it goes around 30 some odd times, and then it crashes into the planet itself, so it doesn't muck up the moons of Jupiter. What are the chances that it won't work, that it could just get sucked in by that, you know, infamous Jupiter gravity and not be able to do its job?
Well, I don't think we're worried too much about that because we know the mass of Jupiter and we know the mass of the Juno spacecraft. And we're pretty good at knowing Newton's universal law of gravity, which dictates how close we can fly to Jupiter and what trajectory we have to fly. Now, bad things happen in space, right? Let's say the engine doesn't act or fire as long as it should, and it doesn't slow down enough for Jupiter's gravity to capture the spacecraft into orbit. Then we fly by the target, and the mission is over. That's bad. If the engine fires too long, which is unlikely but could happen, then it crashes into the planet because it'll fly too close to the planet and the planet's gravity, as we've pointed out, is powerful, and that would end the mission prematurely. So lots of things can go wrong, and space is a nasty place, and this is a very hazardous environment.
Again, if you want to check out the picture of Mal's model, go to our website. It's nhpr.org/exchange. You can also send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Our Sky Guys are here today, Mal Cameron, John Gianforte. We're catching up on some of the latest headlines in space science, including, as we've been talking about, this Juno spacecraft that on July 4th will fly incredibly close to Jupiter and take all sorts of cool photos. And Mal, one more thought from you on this. Yeah,
I just wanted to let everybody know that there is a New Hampshire connection to the Juno spacecraft, and that is that the computer on board was built by BAE Systems, and it's one that they've flown before in space because it's designed for high radiation environments. It's called their RAD 750 computer. It's called a single board computer. I have no idea what that means, but it sounds good when I say it. But it's been on other NASA missions looking at flying through the Van Allen probes And the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter and Curiosity on Mars also has that same computer on it.
Which we'll definitely talk about Mars and Curiosity in just a second. But there's a student of yours too, John, who also had something to do with this. So lots of New Hampshire connections.
I'm really proud of George Clark, who was one of my early students when I began teaching astronomy for Granite State. I had him when I taught up there in the Rochester campus. And he went on to the University of New Hampshire, got his bachelor's degree in physics, went on to the University of Texas in San Antonio, and got himself on the Juno team. And now he is one of the in fact, he flew out to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory yesterday for the encounter, the orbital insertion on Monday. And he's very excited. He has a huge role in the JEDI mission, the Jovian Energetic Particle Detection Instrument. And he's going to be collaborating with later this year with the Japanese Space Agency in Japan. And I can't say how proud we are here of his efforts to be a part of this huge, important mission to the biggest planet in the solar system.
Well, Granite State connections all the way out to Jupiter. That's great. And best acronym ever, by the way, for a mission.
I agree. Love it.
Again, the phone number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And if you're on Twitter, check out the picture that we've got of Mal's model of the Juno spacecraft. So, Mal, kicking off with you, let's talk about Curiosity and the rover on Mars. And my goodness, it's been up there forever. First of all, just remind us how long it has been there.
I forgot when it actually, when did it land, John?
August 2012.
It was 2012.
Okay.
Yes. This is another spacecraft that normally we go to Mars. This is completely opposite. We go to Mars and we bring solar panels. So that's what we did on Spirit and Opportunity. So now we've swapped out. We gave Juno the solar panels, and now on Mars we have the one that's nuclear powered. But that's good because one of the things you eliminate by doing that is you don't have to worry so much about the dust that accumulates on solar panels, which we've run into with the other rovers. Although Mars has been kind to those because every now and then it sends a storm around and wipes them off for us.
Anybody who ever watched the movie The Martian knows about those Martian winds.
Yes.
Because it destroys his his Hab.
You don't
want to
get
lives.
Blown away or whatever.
But. Well, so there's some latest information, right, Mal, from Curiosity, venerable as it may be, about volcanoes
more
on Mars.
Yeah. Oh, volcanoes. Well, I'm not up on that, I have to admit. I will say I'm more thinking of the way it's tracking. It's in this Gale crater, and there's a mountain in the middle of it called Mount Sharp. And over a period of time, they just passed a plateau where they're now at the base of the mountain. They're heading toward there to head up. And this is where the higher you go, the more samples you take of rocks and things to find out the history behind it all. So maybe John can talk about the volcano.
So Curiosity still roaming around and heading to this crater, which I
yes.
know people have been interested in
but
for a
while. But
this
is the beauty of the nuclear power. It's going to last a long time, and as long as the wheels don't fall off or something, we're in good shape.
John?
Well, you mentioned The Martian. One of the interesting things about that movie was that Matt Damon actually retrieves a radioisotope thermoelectric generator, the thing he digs out of the sand, and uses it to keep the rover warm while he's inside so he doesn't freeze to death. So this is exactly the same kind of power supply that Curiosity has. So it can provide the electrical needs of this very advanced roving space laboratory for up to 10 years. And the big thing that Curiosity went to Mars to determine if Mars ever provided or provides today a potentially habitable environment for Mars.
Well, and that's a perfect segue into what we're going to talk about in just a minute. A new forthcoming movie about human life on Mars, and it raises a lot of questions. We'll talk about that in just a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the latest in space science with our sky guys. We've been talking about a July 4th flyover, the planet Jupiter, the mission called Juno. We will give us the closest photos ever of the giant planet. Also, we've been talking about Curiosity, which is still roaming around on Mars 4 years after, roughly, it dropped down. There's some new information from Curiosity about the red planet. We're taking your questions and comments, too. The Exchange number, 1-800 892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, 1-800-892-6477. So, guys, just before the break, we were talking about Curiosity, and I'm not sure how long it was supposed to last, but it's lasted a long time on Mars. And, John, you were about to give us an update on some of the new things that Curiosity has been doing.
Well, we outlined what its major goal was, and long ago, even though it's only been there a couple of years, it's proven that Mars once was and provided a habitable environment for life. What's more, once we drilled into the rocks and analyzed the drilled material, we realized that there are organic compounds on Mars. Organic compounds are simply compounds that have the element carbon in them, which on Earth is essential for life that we understand it. So now we know that there's water. There's water on Mars, lots and lots of water.
So sorry to interrupt you, but that's the present tense.
That's right.
There is right now.
There's lots and lots of water on Mars. There's no flowing rivers. There's no open lakes. But just beneath the surface, we believe now that there is liquid water. There's lots of ice on Mars, too. So we know that Mars provided a habitable environment. You couldn't live on the surface of Mars without lots of protection, but what about underground? A very distinct possibility. And we still don't know if there's life on Mars underground a meter or two deep in caverns. We don't know. And that's something that Curiosity will help us. One recent discovery that Curiosity made was manganese oxides that it has found as a mineral. These deposits only form in the presence of abundant water, which have told scientists now that it's beyond a doubt that Mars was much warmer, much wetter, and had a more oxygen-rich atmosphere in the distant past. But something happened inside of Mars. That something is that its molten core that the Earth still has today solidified, and that is a requirement for a planet to have a magnetic field, which is what we're going to Jupiter to discover. Nothing wrong with Jupiter's magnetic field, but billions of years ago on Mars, because its metallic core solidified, its magnetic field dissipated. So the magnetic field of a planet protects it from the solar wind, the charged particles from the sun. And without the magnetic field, if you're a planet and you have an atmosphere, that solar wind blows by you at 400 kilometers per second and eventually erodes your atmosphere away.
So the big mystery then, guys, is what the heck happened to Mars's atmosphere?
Well, we know now. The solar wind...
Because of that.
Yes. And because of that, the atmospheric thickness, the atmospheric pressure on the surface of Mars is about 1% as thick as the Earth's atmosphere. So there's still weather, there's still water vapor, a little bit of water vapor, a hint of oxygen, mainly carbon dioxide, and still there's wind, clouds, even some precipitation on Mars. But the thick atmosphere that allowed liquid water on the surface 2 billion years ago or more is gone.
And the atmosphere is partly related to the core of the planet?
Well, only through the fact that a planetary magnetic field, like the Earth has, like Jupiter has, and some of the other planets have, acts as a shield to protect the planet against charged particles that mainly emanate from the sun in the form of its solar wind. The solar wind is a wind that blows out from the sun in all directions between 300 and 800 kilometers per second of varying particle densities, protons and electrons from the sun. And these particles are deflected by a magnetic field. If you're a planet and you don't have a magnetic field, no shield. So that's a bad thing if you want to breathe on a planet.
Yeah, for starters. Well, and we talked a couple of minutes ago about the movie The Martian, which, you know, had all sorts of Oscar nominations and really got people talking, including the three of us, about, you know, the possibility of living on Mars. There's this astronaut who's left behind and so forth. There's a new Mars movie coming out, guys, at the end of the year called The Space Between Us. Now, the premise is a little different. It's that one of the female astronauts on this mission to colonize Mars, not just go and visit and dig around, She's unknowingly pregnant. She gives birth after they land on Mars. By the way, the mission keeps that a secret. That's another one of those Hollywood plots. We can't tell people there's this baby born on Mars. So this child grows up in a very low-gravity environment. And, of course, as he gets older, he desperately wants to see Earth. But, as you guys know already, there's all sorts of health problems associated with that. And it does raise a lot of interesting scientific questions about the human body on other planets and what an amazing ability our planet has to support our form of life. Let's hear just a little clip from The Space Between Us, because there's some science in this, and then I want to get your opinion.
His heart will simply not have the strength in the Earth's gravity. Bones will be brittle.
He wouldn't even survive the trip back to Earth.
So the child remains classified on Mars?
Yes.
Okay, so he's classified. We won't talk about that right now. But Mel, I did think it was really interesting. You know, his heart won't make it. His bones won't make it. And in the movie, you know, this adorable teenage boy is just desperate to go down to Earth and meet other teenagers. And who can blame him?
Well, there's a few things. First of all, if he's growing up on Mars, hopefully he's in a radiation-protected environment. And he's still going to have to wear a space. I wonder if they make. How do they get a baby spacesuit?
I'm
trying
not
to
sure.
think of all that. And I don't know whether they jump ahead in
time. Well, he just can't go outside.
He just can't.
His mom doesn't say go
outside
and play.
Go back in your room and stay in your shielded room. I keep thinking about, okay, what if we went to Mars? What do we have to contend with? The gravity is about one-third of the gravity of the Earth. So with our strength and the way our bodies are built for Earth, we could do things. If we wanted to play basketball, for example, then you have to put that net about three times higher, you know, so that you could jump that high. You know, your jump shots would be great.
That would improve my game because I'm not very good.
Imagine the size of tennis courts,
right. Perhaps,
you know, and don't hit it too hard or you might wing them. So imagine somebody who's growing up in that environment and coming to Earth.
It would feel crushingly heavy, wouldn't it?
It would. I always had the story that I thought that when we had the H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds, the Martians attacking us, you know, big mistake unless they really beef themselves up somehow. In my mind, we don't have to worry about Martians or little green men or whatever coming to Earth because they're going to weigh three times more than what they weighed on Mars if they land and try to walk around. They would hardly be able to move.
Never mind.
In my mind,
us.
You just grab a bunch of trash bags and open them up and pick them up and throw them away. We would win. Wrong move. So there is some science to that. I'm sure that it would affect the heart, the bones. Well, if it's brittle, it could even come from some of the radiation that Mars had, because I'm sure if he's, 16 or mm-hmm. so?
He's 16 when he
16,
finally makes it back.
Of course. He has to have a driver's license in order to come. But when they come, if he's been for 16 years, there must have been some times where he got some radiation exposure as well. What's that going to do to him?
Well, and, you know, again, it's mostly a coming-of-age saga and a teenage love story. But what do you make of this, John, the idea that twice in a 12-month period, basically, here's Hollywood, you know, cranking out these Mars-inspired, NASA-endorsed movies?
Well, bad science and all, I think it's good. Because it gets people talking about the possibility of humans going to Mars to explore and eventually to colonize and live there. Now, that brings with it a whole bunch of other problems that we don't have time to talk about today. But I think we're all missing the boat on this movie. I think the biggest hazard this young person has on Mars is being raised by 14 scientists.
Well, and
to tell
and,
you the yes, truth,
yeah.
and, think about that for a minute.
And kidding
That's
aside,
true.
You know, he says, I'm getting kind of sick of being around adults. And, you know, anybody
so,
who's had a teenager
can
completely understand that.
In seriousness, though.
The social aspects to this.
Yeah, that's really an interesting thing to consider. Mm. I don't think a movie has really dealt with that. And I'm anxious to see the movie just because of that. Because on the other side, though, I think it's a little – and I'm not a medical doctor and I don't know physiology – but the human body, the genes that make us up, have evolved on this planet for hundreds and thousands and millions of years and have given us the equipment to survive here. The fact that this kid spends 16 years, the first 16 years of his life, in a lower gravity environment, not zero gravity, but lower – I don't think after a period of equalization back on Earth, I think it'll be fine. That not, may not make a good a storyline as what they've put together for this movie, but I think eventually he'll be okay. That's my thought on him adapting to Earth environment, because his genes are from Earth, and those genes were had evolved under Earth gravity, Earth's atmosphere, Earth's light level, that should enable him to adapt to the Earth environment.
Interesting. Well, and last question for you on this, because again, it's just a movie, it's Hollywood, but I do think it's interesting that there's some science in here. And I do wonder what you also think, Mal, of the idea that, you know, Hollywood keeps churning out these Let's Go to Mars movies.
It almost looks like a reverse of The Martian, you know, putting an Earth person on Mars,
right?
And how do they survive? Right? Yeah. And then they say, okay, well, what if we did it the other way?
That's good. I like that. That's interesting.
You know, but again, it sounds like at least they're trying to put some science into it. And it'll be, we all know until we see the movie, obviously, and it's not till the end of the year sometime,
right? Well, so, and commercial space companies, we've talked about this before, guys. You know, Elon Musk's outfit and Jeff
SpaceX,
Bezos, I think, is working on this and so forth. Are these private companies focusing on Mars, or are they just doing lower-level stuff?
Well, SpaceX is coming up with a crew compartment that are going to – they've been busy sending stuff. They've been doing some commercial satellite work, and just recently they sent a satellite up for a private company. But they're more well-known for supplying the space station with supplies. And the unusual thing about SpaceX is that they bring their capsule back and they can send stuff from the space station back to Earth, experiments and so on. They're extremely innovative. Not that the others are not, but they're really aiming big. But they're working on this Dragon space capsule that will carry as many as 7 astronauts into space at some point, with the concept that possibly that could even be used for going out deeper than the space station, I would think, even though NASA is also working on their Orion spacecraft. But SpaceX and Orbital Sciences also has a space program that they've been supplying the space station with. And they're all coming in cheaper in the long run than anything else. And this is why NASA is very interested in working with them. But they're also working outside of NASA for other things as well. SpaceX, I can tell you from just a few years ago when I was at Kennedy Space Center watching the Juno launch, part of the tour we had was that one of the main launch platforms that they had, they have 39A and 39B, I think it's 39A or whatever, where all the shuttles took off, is now being refurbished for some of SpaceX's future flights, and they're building their own facility nearby that.
So a lot more private entrepreneurship alongside NASA's efforts.
Right.
Just recently, Elon Musk announced that he's going to Mars in 2024 and that he's called in the lawyers.
Wait.
What? There was a headline about a month ago that Elon Musk is going to send a mission to Mars in 2024 and that he's so serious about it that he's called in the lawyers because international law forbids a private organization to go to another planet.
Really?
So
why is that?
So I don't know why, but 20 years ago, to think that a private company rather than a nation with a well-funded space program would ever travel to interplanetary destinations was virtually unthinkable. I'm sure somebody thought of it, but it wasn't in our present experience at the time. So if SpaceX sends a mission to Mars in the next 10, 12, 15 years, the U.S. government will be responsible for their actions on Mars. So he's calling in the lawyers to make sure to pave the way for this mission in 10 to 14 years to actually happen. Now, whether it's 14 years or 16 years or 20 years, that's pretty soon. to send people to Mars. It's not a 50 to 100-year thing.
That's
right?
Something that the three of us
we could
might
foreseeably
see in
watch
our
this
lifetimes.
Happen from here, right? So this is actually old news. This is a month old. I read this about Elon Musk. And there's a whole bunch of companies today that are in business hiring people to expand the economies of the Earth into outer space. A company called Planetary Resources is planning missions to explore and excavate asteroids so that we can mine them. And there are companies, other companies, that will be developing the infrastructure to allow people to work on an asteroid, on Mars, to live. There has to be sanitation.
Who's going to take out the trash on that asteroid? Let me just jump in, John, because this is really, really interesting. And I did not realize it was so imminent and that some private companies are so serious. I want to ask our listeners, would you apply for that job to go to outer space, to go to the asteroid, whether to wash the dishes or take out the trash or walk around or whatever, with commercial space travel? Would you do it? What do you make of some of these efforts that we're hearing about? Again, the number here in the exchange for you to join our conversation with the Sky Guys is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. So go ahead, Mal. This is really interesting.
I'm thinking of the company, and I forgot the name, John. Mars. It's a private company that wants to do the one-way trip.
Mars One.
Mars One. That's it.
A Dutch company.
A Dutch company. They are signing people up and taking applicants at least. I think they had like 100,000 people apply.
Yeah, 100,000 originally sign up.
Right. And they're
for a one-way trip.
For a one-way trip to Mars.
I think we talked about that in an earlier program.
Possibly.
Yeah.
They're down to 100 possibly. Candidates now.
Yeah. Are you one?
No.
No. Okay. I'm not either, so I didn't – I'm not interested in that. But
so, I mean, we're kind of chuckling, but people are really signing up for
this. But this is very serious stuff. You know, people want to go to Mars, and there are people willing just to go there to say, okay, I know I'm going to die there. I'm not coming home. But I want to have my name go down in history, I guess, as one of the first people that landed on Mars, to colonize it, to build things, to live there and learn how to live there. And this is a private firm. So I'd be interested to hear how many would be interested in going to Mars one way and not
being
able to
right.
come back. Well,
right. So too. Maybe some of our listeners will let us know whether they would try to buy a round-trip ticket or that one-way ticket.
Of course, you may know somebody you'd like to send there, too. It's always possible.
Well, yeah. John's pointing at Mal. Well, maybe in a moment, nobody knows the answer to this, but the idea that, let's say, one of these private American companies sends some Americans to Mars and then they get into trouble, who's responsible for bringing them back or getting them out of that trouble? We will talk about that in just a moment. And let's hear from you. Again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Keep it right here. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the latest space headlines and astronomy news with our Sky Guys, including real, serious, ongoing efforts that are not that far away to send humans to Mars. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also find us on Facebook or Twitter. Mal Cameron's here, former astronomy and space educator at the McAuliffe-Shepard Discovery Center, coordinator of its NASA Educator Resource Center. John Gianforte's with us, co-founder of the Astronomical Society of Northern New England and an astronomy instructor for Granite State College and UNH. 1-800-892-6477, again, is the number. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And guys, let's go to our listeners now. And Eric is calling in from Conway. Hi, Eric. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome. Eric, are you with us? Go ahead.
Yes, I am. This manned space travel thing, I can't get too excited about unless we solve two problems. And that's getting people out of the gravity well of Earth without blowing them off the planet on a dangerous and expensive, with basically a Roman candle. And then once we get out of the gravity well, we have to be able to travel at a speed that's going to get us somewhere in a reasonable length of time. And I'm just wondering what's kind of research is being done in this area?
Great questions, especially on the second one, John. Yeah. You know, right now, most of our ships are just kind of slow. It's a nine-month trip to Mars.
Yeah, he has two great points. We expend a lot of resources in fuel to get somebody, as he says, out of the gravity well to leave Earth behind. It's very expensive for resource-wise and money-wise. And also, our propulsion systems that we are currently using, chemical rockets or liquid-propelled rockets, are inefficient, very inefficient. But I should say that there's a NASA spacecraft right now that happens to be orbiting the largest asteroid and dwarf planet Ceres that has an ion propulsion engine, an extremely efficient engine that was first – this is the first interplanetary journey that an ion propulsion system has been used on, and it was very successful. So it was the first one. Obviously, it needs to be improved. So that it can go faster and can carry bigger payloads, a human mission to a different planet. So we should understand that there are divisions of NASA and private firms working on advanced propulsion systems that don't rely on conventional rockets, nuclear-powered, ion propulsion systems, magnetic propulsion systems that are more efficient and faster. We just don't have them today.
I have a really simple question. And again, I'm looking at this great model that you made, Mal, of the Juno spacecraft. It seems like, please correct me if I'm wrong, it seems like, as our caller points out, you know, getting out of the atmosphere is a big problem. It right. seems like, Mal, from all our conversations over the years, that once you get out there, there has been a lot of innovation in terms of just moving along, in terms of these solar panels, for example.
Just to add what John was talking about, the ion propulsion is a very unique thing. It's very safe to do, and the problem with it, it doesn't have a boost of acceleration right off the bat. You start it up, and you hardly even know anything started. But it has a progressively faster and faster motion to it so that you can propel things through space. However, to get that, correct me if I'm wrong, John, which you probably will, but but I'm thinking that in order to get that ion propulsion into space, you can't blast off with it into space.
No,
you
it
need a
no,
standard yeah. rocket to get up
exactly.
there in the first place.
Standard
and I think that's what
fuel,
Eric was talking about.
Petroleum-based.
Yeah, whatever, yeah. A solid fuel or liquid fuel, it doesn't matter. You've still got to get the force to lift you off the ground. If you've got a million-pound spacecraft sitting on a launch pad, you need more than a million pounds of thrust in
sure.
order to get that up into space.
Well, I appreciate what he says. I mean, it does seem sort of dreadfully old-fashioned that we're still lifting stuff off like he says Roman candles.
He's right. The Earth's escape velocity is 7 miles per second. You have to throw a tennis ball, a baseball, a spaceship at the speed of 7 miles a second to escape the Earth's gravity. And to do that, you need to apply energy to your spacecraft to reach that speed so you can break free of the Earth's gravity. Now, in flight, you don't need to burn your rocket motor. You coast to Mars, okay? So you only need to make small corrections with rocket motors. But I know that we have on the docket to talk about later in today's program about gravitational waves. But I have a great tie-in between gravitational waves and space travel. When the time is right, we can do that. But I think Eric brings up two great points. The other great point is radiation protection. When you leave the Earth's magnetosphere and atmosphere behind, which you do when you leave Earth orbit, you have no protection against the solar wind, just like Mars doesn't, and you have no protection against radiation from the sun.
Well, and we've talked before about that's one of the major perils for anybody traveling very far is radiation in space and the effect on the human body. In fact, I think we talked a couple months ago, guys, about how one of the ideal couples to send to Mars would be a middle-aged couple because they wouldn't be thinking about having children. Because radiation can impair your ability to have children. Wow, so much to talk about. Let's take another call, and Richard's joining us from Portsmouth. Hi, Richard, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura.
Hi.
Yes. I was wondering, thanks, great show. I was wondering why the focus has always been on Mars. I noticed that NASA did a a study recently called Havoc about having floating cities essentially on Venus. And there certainly seems to be a certain surfacism where, geez, you've got to walk around on Mars or the moon or some location. But Venus has the big advantage that you would weigh 9/10 of what we weigh on Earth, and you wouldn't have to really worry about, which we really don't have done much studies on, the gravity problems and issues of living there. And also, if you live in the cloud tops, the temperatures are not a whole lot hotter than they get on Earth, and the clouds keep out almost all the radiation. So it solves a lot of the biological problems, not to mention Venus is almost half the distance that Mars has, and it has a tremendous amount of solar energy, so we wouldn't have to worry about bringing nuclear energy sources, you know, in a place like Mars where you don't get as much solar energy. So it seems like a much better win-win if we can get over not having to walk around on the surface.
Richard, I love this call. Thank you so much. Because, Mal, you know, Mars. What about Venus?
I wouldn't want to go there. It's unclear, Richard, I'm not sure whether cloud tops are like a city that's floating in the cloud tops that is not enclosed, because you got to remember those clouds on Venus are just pure carbon dioxide, and that would not be good for us.
Say nothing of the sulfur dioxide it's an extremely acidic environment in the atmosphere.
It's poison, basically, right? That's how Venus is often described.
Sulfuric acid is raining on the planet
The time. Sulfuric acid.
And that
raining?
Would, yes. Yes.
Yikes.
If you were on the surface, you don't want to go there because the temperature on the surface around the entire planet is roughly 900 degrees Fahrenheit.
But he's getting around that by being suspended in the atmosphere. And you can find a pressure and temperature in the Venusian atmosphere that is similar to Earth. So he has a point there. But I'm not so sure how you could keep something suspended in the atmosphere because you're constantly having to fire rockets to keep yourself elevated. You can't just sit stationary in orbit unless you have some kind of very, very durable balloon.
So on the planet itself, it's very nasty, much nastier than Mars. You would have to be suspended above the planet, as our caller suggests, and that involves a whole host of other technical challenges. Right.
And so there's no way to grow anything. You can't have crops unless you have to have this all self-contained somehow. That would be very difficult to do and very dangerous in the process.
But so was going to the moon. That was very dangerous and difficult.
And that was only for a short period of time.
Right.
Not to colonize it or live there necessarily.
Rich, I'm so glad you called because I think it's an interesting question. We focus so much on Mars, one neighbor on one end, but we don't talk that much about Venus on the other. And the other thing is, John, just recently the European Space Agency discovered a ferocious wind on Venus. How ferocious is it, in addition to all the raining sulfuric acid and that nasty stuff?
Well, one of the things that the European Space Agency's Venus Express found over a period of years, and this confirms earlier findings by the NASA Pioneer Venus mission in the late 1980s, was that Venus has no magnetic field like Mars and unlike Earth. Venus has many similar traits, characteristics, and features to the Earth, the atmosphere not being one of them. But Venus has no magnetic field, even though its core is still molten. The fact that Venus rotates extremely slowly prevents it from having a planetary magnetic field. So it has no shield from the solar wind or the charged particles. Now, Venus does have pretty strong gravity, about 85% of the gravitational strength that the Earth does. So it's able to hold on to a thick atmosphere. So one of the things that you brought up about this electric wind on Venus is that the solar wind wraps around Venus. And it gets really it can penetrate very close to the cloud tops of Venus. And when it wraps around it, it has the ability to strip off oxygen atoms.
That's a powerful wind.
Well, the solar wind is very powerful. But the interaction with The interplanetary magnetic field, mainly emanating from the sun, has the ability, as it wraps around Venus, to strip off oxygen and hydrogen molecules that may have once been water at the surface of Venus.
Well, and the European Space Agency and other scientists are saying this is important to know about because as we look at other Earth-like planets, it would be good to know in advance if they have this so-called electric wind that has been discovered on Venus. Here's Glenn Collison. He's a scientist with NASA's Goddard Space Center, just explaining why it's important to know about these electric winds.
It is no good having conditions perfect for an ocean and an atmosphere that you might want to breathe if some invisible force is going to come along and rip it all off into space. Only understanding how atmospheres evolve can we try and understand how we got here.
Again, that's Glenn Collison, a scientist with NASA's Goddard Space Center. Our Sky Guys are with us in studio for a few more minutes, and you can join us as well. 1-800-892-6477. And gentlemen, Fletcher just left. Jerry and Keene is with us. Go ahead, Jerry, you're on the exchange. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
You guys were laughing a bit ago about the lawyers and such, but, you know, it does remind me of an earlier period of exploration, you know, when Europe was trying to find out where the rest of the world was. You know, and it started out with the governments, like Prince Henry the Navigator, sending out his ships. Then corporations like the Hudson Bay Company went out. And you look at what a mess we made of all of that stuff. You know, it would be really good if we could figure out whether or not all this stuff that's going to be happening, all this exciting stuff, is going to be government-based, corporate-based, and if it's either one, once people get out there, how are we going to govern ourselves? How are we going to protect people out there? You know, you don't want to see people going out and becoming indentured servants, for instance, or even, you know, a new form of slavery and such. So I think getting lawyers involved might not be a bad idea. Have you given any thought to the science of human nature?
Yeah.
Jerry,
yeah.
This is a great point.
It's a great question.
I love your historical analogy because he's right, Mal. Yeah. When we were exploring the New World, you know, it was kings and queens underwriting these expeditions, but there are also private interests involved. So, Jerry, thank you so much.
Exactly. What we did is, of course, we kicked out the king's rules and made our own country, too. And in a sense, I can see that's what you have to do if you're going to a new world. There has to be some sort of law in effect that people need to abide by. Otherwise, it's anarchy and they all kill each other off or something, and that would not be a good thing. So, we need something that everybody can abide by and agree to. So I can see where the lawyers would be a big help there.
Well, there's laws being formulated now to protect people when they go and make a reservation for these low Earth orbiting hotels that will be present in the next 5 to 10 years. So we're not saying that lawyers aren't necessary and nor are laws necessary. We'll certainly need them. But the fact that Musk is calling lawyers into play now means it's getting serious because those kinds of measures will have to be in place.
Well, I did want to bring up one more topic with you guys. And John, you touched on it earlier. A couple months ago, this happened, but scientists are still jazzed about it. Gravitational waves recorded not once, but twice by an observatory that's set up to look for these. Now, super short, super easy. What's a gravitational wave?
Well, you know what light waves are. You know what sound waves are. Gravitational waves, predicted by Einstein's general theory of relativity in 1915, predict that gravity works in waves also. But the problem with them is that they're extremely difficult to detect. They're very low amplitude, similar to low volume coming from a radio. So they're very difficult to detect. And in September, the LIGO Observatory in Washington State and Louisiana, two identical observatories set up specially to detect these gravitational waves, detected for the first time gravitational waves from a very massive object. In this case, two black holes merging some 4 billion light years away.
And they actually make a sound, sort of. We have here an audio representation of the sound recorded by LIGO, those observatories you mentioned, of two black holes careening into each other. This is real short, this audio courtesy of the NPR show Science Friday. That's it. That's all we've got for you.
So they just translated the data into audio so we could listen to how short a duration it was. But the motion detection capability of the LIGO Observatory is a thousandth of the diameter of a proton. I mean, a proton is a piece of an atom. And a thousandth of the diameter of a proton is an amazingly small, short distance.
So teeny, 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 teeny.
So they're really hard to detect.
Well, speaking of distances, got an email here from Richard in Chester who says, no way would I go to Mars willingly, nor any planet, not for any price. I hear you, Richard. I'm right there with you. The thought of being enclosed in a capsule, spacesuit, or module terrifies me and inflames my moderate sense of claustrophobia. If that wasn't enough, Richard says, I'd greatly miss the green of Earth, the wind, the warmth, and all the other attributes of our beautiful planet. And Richard, that movie that we talked about earlier, really, it's partly about what it's like to live on Mars, but a lot of it's a love letter to the planet Earth. It does make you realize, through the eyes of this boy born on Mars, he gets down to Earth, he says, it's so beautiful here. And you kind of watch it, you go, yeah, he's right. So thank you so much for the email, Richard. And to mark that flyby of Jupiter by Juno, we're going out today on the classical music piece, Juno, the Bringer of Jollity, from Holst's The Planets. Thank you guys for being here. This is The Exchange on NHPR.